The Anton Savage Show
with Kearies.ie
on News Talk.
I'm joined by one of the few people that you can say to during the ad break, you know, I'm fascinated by gut bacteria, and they continue the conversation with you instead of leaving. That is Sarah Keogh, our expert dietitian. Buckets of questions coming in. The reason why I was pitching to Sarah my interest in gut bacteria is because one of the texts that came in during the break was one that says a woman, referring to her mother, 88 years of age, has tummy bowel problems. She's seen a specialist, has had scans, lower colonoscopy, all clear, taking Alflorex as per specialist. We'd like to find out what's causing her problems still as it's getting her down.
So, I mean, one of the issues as people get a lot older, we're a little more hesitant to do a lot of sort of invasive tests and things like that. But I work with the Celiac Society, and actually getting diagnosed with celiac disease in your 80s is not rare. So it may have been done, but a colonoscopy wouldn't show up celiac disease. It's usually an endoscopy, but there's a blood test that's probably worth checking out. But other than that, I take them to see a dietitian because, you know, if everything else has been checked and ruled out, very often changes in diet. And I was only with someone last week who was in their 80s with similar issues and just sorting a few things out with that. So sometimes the gut's just slowing down as you get older, which can just be part of it. The Alflorex is no harm to try.
And this brought us to our ad break discussion on gut bacteria generally. Gut bacteria is still, it is like the Mariana Deep. There's a lot of stuff down there.
Oh,
we don't know what it is.
It's in its absolute infancy. And, you know, I was only reading something on Twitter from a good researcher. They're going, like, people are just trawling through that, generating stuff. And they're going, one of the things in science is you tend to head off with a hypothesis going, this is what we're looking for. Whereas instead, they're just trawling through things. So it's a little all over the place. I mean, we're starting to get an understanding, but I'd say we're 150 years off actually really understanding gut bacteria, because there's so many and we haven't even identified most of them, let alone what they do and how they work and so on. So,
And they tend to be unique, don't they? Everybody has a fingerprint of their own bacteria.
Pretty much. I mean, in terms of, we will have a lot of the same bacteria, but the proportion of them can be different, and you can have different ones depending on what you're eating. Diet is going to be your number one influence on your gut bacteria. What you eat basically feeds your gut bacteria. So whether they grow or don't grow is really reflected in what you eat. And that's where fiber and plant foods and things like that are incredibly important for the gut.
Unsurprising, because we were talking about it because it's front page of the Examiner today, the issue of Donal O'Shea, the clinical lead for the HSE in relation to obesity, talking about the pharmacological advancements in respect of treatment to obesity and how it may be ending. A lot of questions about Ozempic, best summarised by one that says, what are the side effects, if any, of Ozempic?
So there are side effects. I mean, any medication you take is going to have side effects. And if we look at Ozempic or Wegovy, they're going to be a hormonal treatment, and hormones are quite complicated in the body. So there can be side effects. So definitely some people sail through it and no bother at all. Other people are feeling a bit nauseous, can feel a little bit unwell with it. But I think if it's something that you want to try, that, you know, if you're at kind of the cutoff in terms of it, definitely conversation with your GP and try it and see, does it work for you? I mean, it's just the most amazing breakthrough in terms of weight. And, you know, it's dietitians absolutely welcome it, because we often say, do you? And they're like, 100%, because who has been at the coalface of weight treatment for decades? And, you know, myself working in clinics for years, I would always see this. You would get to know in terms of a patient where it wasn't willpower, it wasn't not knowing about food. There was something else going on in terms of appetite regulation.
Now, can you explain that? Because that, and I'm not seeking to be offensive, I'm trying to give voice to what comes in a lot by text. And a lot of people will say, whenever you talk about obesity, they will say, look, we all know that there is at the heart of this a calorie deficit thing. If you take in less than you put out, you will get skinnier. Yeah. So all you have to do is, the classic thing that drives Donal O'Shea mad, eat less, move more. Why does it not work?
It works for lots of people. But what I would have observed, as you know, over the years, is once people hit maybe 17 stone, it was very, very difficult to achieve weight loss with people. Now, not always, and it's not universal, but this is just what I would have seen. Under that, yes, changes in nutrition, changes in food, that really works. But there is a point where you can see there's just a problem with how the body itself is controlling the appetite. And we have a whole slew of hormones in our bodies that tell us when we're hungry, tell us when we're full. We feedback loops into the brain to talk about, you know, even just weight in the stomach and so on. If there is a breakdown in communication and how those hormones, and remember, hormones are messengers, they have to deliver a message. If they don't deliver that message, it doesn't get through. So if the hormone that tells you you're full never gets to deliver its message, you have this huge appetite. And, you know, and I think I was at a conference, and I think it was Donal O'Shea or Carol LaRue who said, telling someone with this hormonal disruption not to eat is like telling someone not to breathe. You can try holding your breath, you can try not eating, but sooner or later the body will just take over and make you do it. And that's what happens here. And this is where I kind of go, you know, people who think it's all willpower and just eat less need to just sit down. You've never actually worked with people struggling with this, if that's your attitude, to be perfectly honest. And to see that there's a treatment here for people who have struggled and suffered so much, I think is just fantastic. And what I love, I don't know if you saw this report during the week, that we are now seeing improvements in fertility. with women. And it's not just lovely that we're now actually, you know, this thing of we'll just go off to lose weight to get pregnant. Well, if it was that easy, people would have done it years ago. And I just thought that was one of the loveliest things that we're starting to see. And we're coming in out of Maynooth University there. We're showing reduction or increases in what we call natural killer cells in the body, which are anti-cancer cells. And we know that people with obesity are at higher risk of cancer. So we're looking at that with the Ozempic, that we're going to reduce cancer in these people. Like, it's just fantastic. It really is.
It's still early days.
Yes.
Do we need to have a lot more medical evidence around its application before we wrap arms around it?
Definitely. We're always going to keep studying. But remember, this is a medication that has been around for a long time for the treatment of diabetes. So it's not that it's newly come onto the market. So in that sense, it's a new way of it being used, for sure. But it's not a new medication. But you'll always keep an eye on any medication over the years and see what may or may not be coming out from it.
Question for Sarah. What foods to avoid and what is best to eat if you have arthritis?
So the arthritis diets that I see everywhere are 99% rubbish. So you can put them in the bin for most of them. The idea that you have to stop eating tomatoes and acidy foods and all of those sort of things, please no. You can't actually. So for those who don't know, one of the things that's a big trend around arthritis is the idea that if your blood becomes more acidic, that it damages your joints. It's a very common thing around arthritis. So just so you know, you cannot change the acid level of your blood. You can't raise it or lower it because every enzyme in your body depends on a very specific level of acid in the blood. And if that changes, your enzymes stop working. You die about 5 minutes later. So you actually can't change the acid in your blood. So these diets
that go... So if you haven't recently died, you know your blood acid is okay.
Yeah. Right. So you actually see where that becomes quite dangerous to say kidney failure because the kidneys control acid levels. So these diets that tell you, oh, we're going to change acid levels in your blood, they absolutely do not. So tomatoes, all the rest, don't do anything. If you're going to look, and having worked with osteoarthritis quite a lot, fish oils can be very, very helpful, but they take about 3 months to see an effect. Now, they are more effective in rheumatoid arthritis, no doubt about it, but osteoarthritis, there's some protection there. Vitamin D possibly has a role. What we do see is, though, a general healthy eating pattern. So people who are following, you know, that Mediterranean style diet, lots of fruit and veg, fish and so on, get less arthritis and have fewer symptoms. So basically, take out your food pyramid, have a look, because it's just based on the Mediterranean type diet, have a look at that. The second thing for arthritis, though, especially osteoarthritis, actually exercise and really building the muscle. Because when I was working on the osteoarthritis program, the physiotherapist was brilliant. And she was saying one of the big things to do is those, particularly for knee arthritis, is building those big thigh muscles and butt muscles, because they pull the joints, they keep the joints from rubbing. Like, if you've no muscle sort of pulling joints away from each other, they're just going to rub. Whereas if you exercise and particularly build that muscle, it just supports.
Because in some ways that's kind of counterintuitive. You would have thought, have you a sore joint? Well, then don't overwork it because you'll inflame
but for
it.
Osteoarthritis, exercise actually reduces the pain more than the pain medication. So initially you might take pain medication to go out and do your exercise and obviously talk to your GP about that. You ice the knee when you come back or the joint when you come back. But the exercise, hands down, people with osteoarthritis who can and do keep exercising have better symptoms and it improves with that. So
one thing, Sarah, I had an endoscopy this week and tested positive on bad bug bacteria. What can I... Oh, I assume that must be bad gut bacteria. What can I do after I finish medication?
So what I'm going to think is happening here is if you had an endoscopy, what they probably found was a bacteria in your stomach called H. pylori, which is very common infection in the stomach that causes horrendous heartburn and indigestion. Absolutely awful, awful, awful gastritis.
Is it the one that causes ulcers? Is it the ulcer?
It does, yeah. It used to be the one. Well,
this is the Australian chap.
Yep. This is so... What often happens is when they do an endoscopy, they'll always check if you have this and then they will put you on a 3 week course of quite strong antibiotics. So I'm kind of assuming that's what they have found there. To be honest, that course of antibiotics should clear it. In some cases it doesn't. So usually what you'll get is a referral to get a breath test done in a couple of months' time, which will just be able to tell you if that's cleared up.
A breath test?
So a breath test. So there is a group called, is it GastroLife? And they do, it's really interesting, they look at levels of hydrogen in your breath because the human body doesn't produce hydrogen, but bacteria in your gut will. So if that's quite high levels, it means they're doing things they shouldn't. So they can measure it. Now, it's not that straightforward, but, you know, they're very good. So very often, if someone has this H. pylori, they will have their antibiotic and then later they'll have a breath test to make sure it's gone. Occasionally, people might need a second run of the antibiotics. Now, they're quite hefty. But this H. pylori causes stomach cancer. So actually, it's really important to take your antibiotics and clear it and get it out of your system.
And sorry, the one that I was referring to before, this is wasn't it an Australian doctor, wasn't it, who did the original? He infected himself with H. pylori and then killed it.
As far as I can remember, yeah, and looked at it.
I think that's it.
Is that it? Yeah.
There was something else related to that. Oh, yeah. Question off the back of that. The taking of antibiotics to eradicate a bad gut bacteria, is there a downside to that? that you eradicate good gut bacteria. Can antibiotics cause harm to the gut biome?
Not really. So where we see, I mean, there's a lot of talk about this, and I see lots of people saying, oh, you know, if you take an antibiotic, you have to take a probiotic afterwards. There's very limited evidence to how relevant that actually is, unless you have specific medical conditions with that. So in our house, that doesn't actually happen. So yes, antibiotics will affect other gut bacteria. But if you have an infection, it's actually very important to take the antibiotics that you're prescribed. You know, you go back 100 years ago and people were dying of tiny little cuts and all that sort of thing. So they're important. It really, where I've seen it, where I'd work with a lot of people with gut issues, is if they've been very sick and they've had like 5, 6, 7, 8 antibiotics maybe in a year, where they've had repeated chest infections or something quite serious, that's where we would see more issues with the gut. And you might be working to rebalance that. But someone who's had an ear infection and an antibiotic for a week, not really.
Text to say, sugar.
Okay.
I think I just found out by accident that it is my nemesis, as I have odd small patches of psoriasis and odd aches. 56 and only had tennis elbow. Is sugar the only thing I should be looking at?
So for psoriasis, we don't generally see a particular link with sugar. However, I would tell you at this stage, the human body is weird and wonderful. And if you personally are finding that that's making your psoriasis worse, absolutely cut it out. But with psoriasis, it can be a lot of things. There's a lot of genetics involved in psoriasis. But what's interesting is that with the Celiac Society, a lot of our members would also have psoriasis and it improves. So around 10% of people with psoriasis. Now, don't go on the gluten-free diet off the bat. Go and get tested. But a lot of them, the psoriasis will dramatically improve, if not resolve, with that. The other thing for psoriasis is fish oils, because the EPA, it's specific EPA. So plant omega-3s don't have this. So fish omega-3 EPA can reduce inflammation in the body, and that can help with psoriasis as well. Overall, it's not a particularly diet-related condition. But again, if you find, you know, consistently if you're eating certain foods, it's causing a flare-up, no harm, just to reduce those.
An interesting one. I don't know if this is one that you will be able to answer. It says, Anton, are there any treatments that Sarah could suggest for gout?
Oh, yeah. Well,
now, gout reputationally is an awful thing to have, because everybody thinks it's horrible. Your own fault. They think it's a fault because you're wealthy and they think it's not so bad. And all that is totally
untrue.
Well,
that was the joke years ago. You know, you had to, because to be honest, gout is associated with certain foods, which, you know, poor people generally didn't have access to. So it was kind of, now, can I say, it is the most excruciatingly painful thing. When I worked in hospital, people with it, it is the pain those people are in. God love them. It's horrendous. So
and where is it predominantly in the toes?
Big toe is a common place to get it, but people, you can get in any joint, so fingers, elbows, and it can actually damage the joint really badly with it. However, from a diet point of view, loads of things to do. So most people who get gout will be put on a medication called allopurinol. So basically, gout happens when uric acid crystals build up in the joints. So when we go to the loo, we pee out urine. So urea is what goes in there. If they're not getting those, that uric acid isn't getting flushed out of the body, it can build up in joints. So straight away, the first thing you do is drink lots of water. So if I'm working with someone with gout, it's 3 litres of water a day. So you're literally just flushing out with that. The second thing, and I'm really sorry about this, but just no alcohol. Alcohol, if you want a flare up of gout, if you're prone, that's one of the most spectacular ways to bring it on, is alcohol. So really bring the, and I know when I say that, everyone's like, no, don't do that. But actually it works.
It's the only thing that was getting you through the pain.
And then what you'll get is some foods have higher levels of things called purines in them, and they become urea and stuff in the body. So they would be things like shellfish. And now years ago, you would take people off all kinds of purines. So in meats and all sorts of things and game, you know, when we talk about pheasant, and they would have high levels. We're not big pheasant eaters these days, but shellfish would be a trigger for a lot of people. So to be honest, what I would find, having done this for years, is if you get the water up to the 3 litres a day, cut out the alcohol and really steer clear of the shellfish, that generally does the trick in most people.
So that's why it had the associations with wealth. If you could afford to be drinking Burgundy and eating pheasant,
exactly,
you had a chance that you were more likely to get gout.
Yeah.
To the other end of the spectrum, away from pheasant and Burgundy, there's a question specifically about cheese and cholesterol. Somebody's saying that they have high cholesterol and that this makes them feel that they therefore should avoid cheese. I have high cholesterol. I'm on a tablet that keeps it down. Can I eat cheese as it's my favourite food?
You can absolutely eat cheese. So the thing with cholesterol is that it's a whole diet approach. Sometimes with cholesterol, and, you know, again, I'd have patients coming in over the years kind of going, right, you know, I don't eat butter or cream. I still have high cholesterol. So I get, but there's 100 other things in there. So the thing about cheese, which is interesting, is although cheese is high in saturated fat, and saturated fat is what's made into cholesterol for most people, cheese also has a lot of calcium in it. And we know that calcium actually is, we call it cardioprotective, so it protects the heart a little bit. So there's no direct association between eating cheese specifically and getting heart disease. And so we think the effect of the saturated fat is offset by the calcium. Now, if you're having a pound of cheese a day, different conversation. But if you're having a little bit of cheese every day, it should be fine. But if the cholesterol is still high, I'd always say go and see a dietitian, because for the one session you'd get with a dietitian for your cholesterol, like, people never think of doing that. They'll go to physio, they'll go, you know, honestly, the difference it makes will be huge. And they'll show you all the places to have a look. And without torturing you, they're, you know, it's definitely worth a look.
I bet you there's people who eat a pound of cheese a day.
There absolutely are.
Well, on a similar line, how many eggs is safe to eat per day for a gym-going 18-year-old boy?
Right. So,
Cool Hand Luke, can they hit the 50?
We'll go with the official. The official guidance is that for healthy people, no cholesterol, 7 eggs a week.
Absolutely. A week?
I'm just giving you the guidance.
A week.
If you have high cholesterol, about 4. Now, within that, there will be, we do know now that there's very specific genetic differences between people. And there are people who, when they eat eggs, will get very high cholesterol, and people when they eat eggs that don't. So you will absolutely have that individual thing. So if someone is eating a lot of eggs, probably get a cholesterol check, even if you're young. Because, you know, cholesterol turns up at any age, and we start to see cholesterol lining the arteries in children as young as 12. So it's
not
a thing to wait.
People who begin every day with 2 eggs.
Exactly. And for those people, if they have the particular genetic variant that allows that to work for them, fabulous. It's a great source of nutrition. But if you've the genetic variant that is going to give you high cholesterol from it, and people who have high cholesterol are more likely to have that specific genetic variant. So that's why we really talk about reducing eggs if you do have high cholesterol. But if you have a guy going to the gym and he's doing a lot of eggs a week, just get the cholesterol checked.
Eggs was one of those old school gym trends. I remember talking to an Olympic hammer thrower, and his breakfast used to be a pint glass full of eggs.
Yeah. And you see, again, we're talking about someone who's doing something from a very specific targeted, you know, elite sport versus a person who goes to the gym twice a week. And this is what I keep saying to people. You don't need all these protein shakes. You don't need all these mad diets. Like, you're just going to the gym a couple of times a week. You're not actually bodybuilding for the Olympics. So we could probably just breathe a little bit with some of the protein.
Well, I was like, I remember watching, was it Michael Phelps did a documentary where he was showing his breakfast, and his daily calorie intake was something like 7,000 calories per day. So his breakfast was effectively pancakes soaked in syrup.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly...
But for him, particularly if you're trying to get that enormous amount of calories in, that's how you're going to do it. But most of us who are like really going for a walk for 30 minutes a day don't need to be doing that.
Our resident dietitian, Sarah Keogh. As always with Sarah, there are more questions than we could ever answer. But we will gather the ones up and try to get you to address them the next time you're in, if you're willing.
The Anton Savage Show
with Kiri's.ie
on News Talk.